John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukita, who plays a sour note. W is tie is this, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, April 7th, 2011. One Palestinian killed in Gaza and two injured in Israel, and the Israeli military kidnaps a number of Palestinian civilians in the West Bank. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli shelling has killed one in Gaza and injured three on Thursday, whilst the homemade shell has struck a bus in Beersheba, southern Israel, critically injuring one and moderately injuring another. At the time of this report, the Israeli assault on Gaza is ongoing, and currently sources report that in Gaza there has been one fatality, 50-year-old Mohammed al-Manasra, and 15 have been injured, including two women and three children. Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak has stated that he has instructed the Israeli military to respond, quote, speedily and with every means necessary, end quote, to the homemade shells fired into Beersheba. Today's escalation in violence follows Israeli Air Force bombardment of that, quote, tunnel area, end quote, on the Gaza-Egypt border Wednesday night and an escalation in tension between Israel and Gaza in the past 2 weeks. Israeli soldiers invaded on Thursday morning the Aqaba village east of the central West Bank city of Tobas, declared it as a closed military zone, and demolished two homes. Sami Sadik, head of the Al-Aqaba village council, stated that 95% of the buildings in the village are under the threat of being demolished by the army. This includes the only mosque of the village, the kindergarten, and many homes and structures. Kais Awad, head of Awarta village council, near the northern West Bank city of Nablus, stated that Israeli soldiers invaded Awarta and detained hundreds of residents, including more than 100 women, especially from the eastern area of the village. Soldiers broke into dozens of homes and kidnapped hundreds of residents, apparently as part of an investigation into the stabbing attack that was carried out more than a month ago that led to the death of a settler family from Itamar settlement. Israeli soldiers confiscated on Wednesday several agricultural tractors that belonged to Palestinian residents on the Jordan Valley and took them to a nearby illegal settlement. Local sources reported that soldiers installed a number of roadblocks and stopped the tractors while the residents were heading to their agricultural lands. That sums up our news for today. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You've been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Hassan Fassis and me, George Rishman.
Sunday, multinational forces Iraq, meaning the U.S. military, has reported the death of another U.S. soldier in a non-hostile incident in an undisclosed location in northern Iraq. Ghazni, Afghanistan, Monday, the Polish Defense Ministry is reporting the death of a Polish occupation soldier from unknown causes, presumably non-combat related, at a base in Ghazni, Afghanistan. Baghdad, Iraq, yesterday. Two roadside bombs exploded in quick succession, killing two people and wounding six others, according to a security source. Iraqi officials say a pair of roadside bombs in northern Baghdad killed three people and wounded 11. A Baghdad policeman said the explosions took place only minutes apart late on Tuesday in the capital's Shiite-dominated Judafia neighborhood. He said the bombs were planted about 200 meters away from a cafe and a Shiite mosque. Baji, Iraq, yesterday. A suicide bomber wearing an explosive vest killed three people and wounded seven others when he struck at a car market in Baji, West Mosul. Jurf al-Sakhar, Iraq, Tuesday. Five members of the formerly U.S.-supported, government-backed Sunni Sawa militia were killed when a bomb exploded outside the town of Jurf al-Sakhar, according to police. The Sawa, or Awakening Fighters, are regarded by many as traitors for siding with U.S. troops against insurgents in 2007. Afghanistan, yesterday. Insurgents burned two more NATO oil tankers in southwestern Pakistan as they traveled to Afghanistan. Police official Aziz Ahmad said the attack occurred Wednesday in the district of Bolan in southwestern Baluchistan province. Mr. Barack Obama, 8 years of war in Iraq and nine in Afghanistan have not secured either country. Now's the time to pull the plug, zero out federal spending on these wars, and bring all the troops home today.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me, ain't going back again.
Suppose army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders, torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
City, this is movement music.
Have you heard the news?
Walmart's coming.
Georgia Avenue, uptown, ain't that something?
Something.
Small businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping, cause they know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping.
Something.
See, you can't compete with a superstore who's an importer of slave labors. Craftsmanship, low price to flip to undercut the market, hand over fist.
Walmart
is infamous for the way they behave. Low wage pay, treat the workers like slaves. Employees who try to unionize, soon find themselves in unemployment lines. The way they treat women needs improving. 1.6 million sisters are suing them for being paid less than the male equivalent. On these issues and more, we can't afford to be ignorant.
Keep DC Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunity stops to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
This is the Funkinest Journalist with your three Walmart commandments. Step one, move in and crush competition by underselling. Step two, pay workers nothing and block unionization. Step three, take all that money, put it into the Walton Family Foundation, and turn that into political influence to protect yourself and make even more.
Walmart, it's not a good fit for Chocolate City. Let me holla black at you with the skinny. Important that you clearly understand and remember, DC doesn't work with the right wing agenda. The Walton families are big contributors to bigoted representatives and senators. Trent Lott, sinister, Strom Thurmond, similar, Confederate, state loving George Bush ministers. Oversee your plantation mentality, results in black and brown casualties. Statehood opposition for the district has been supported by Walmart's mischief. The D.C. Voting Rights Act was defeated, assisted via Walmart PACs, and now they wanna come here to see their money stack. Stay up on the facts. Chocolate City, don't relax and fight back.
Keep D.C. Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Out to make a buck quick, suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
Keep DC Walmart free is an emerging activist group of DC residents stepping up to challenge the corporate big box invasion of Chocolate City. Walmart has plans to establish 4 stores in DC by 2012. Walmarts in DC will threaten small businesses, cause loss of more jobs than it will bring to the community, and lower the wage standards for all workers. To find out more and get involved, visit walmartfreedc.org.
On the 5th of April, members of Ward 4 Thrives disrupted a meeting of the DC Council, demanding passage of legislation that would prevent Walmart from opening in D.C. will force them to agree to community benefits, wage, and health care concessions they have stated publicly they would never accept. 400 yellow, frowny face ping pong balls mocking the Walmart smiley face were delivered to the council after first delivering 1,200 signed petitions demanding passage of this legislation to the deputy mayor. Security guards removed the protesters by force, but not before they had accomplished their mission. The proposed legislation was introduced by Councilmember Mendelson and is divided into two components. One bill would require all big box retailers over 75,000 square feet to sign a community benefits agreement with something called the Community Benefits Coalition. This is something Walmart has never once agreed to do in writing. The other bill would directly impose wage and health care provisions on the big box retailers, including a minimum wage for their employees of $11.75 an hour and affordable health insurance, something Walmart has never done. Nobody working at Walmart can afford their high-priced, high-deductible health plans, and Walmart advises their employees to apply for Medicaid instead.
One day after the first anniversary on which President Obama signed his controversial health care reform bill, the Affordable Care Act, into law, Vermont's House of Representatives voted to establish the first single-payer health care system in the United States. If the state Senate adopts the single-payer bill as expected, and it's signed by Vermont's Democratic Governor Peter Shumlin, who supports the bill, all Vermonters will have access to health insurance that supporters say will contain costs. The legislation lays the groundwork to launch a statewide, publicly funded system in 4 years that will eventually marginalize most forms of private, for-profit health insurance. A panel called the Green Mountain Care Board would be allocated $1.2 million to begin developing elements of the new system. A health insurance marketplace, or exchange, would then be established to comply with the federal health care reform law. Finally, if federal waivers are secured, the exchange would be transformed into the Green Mountain Care single-payer system. Dr. Deborah Richter, president of the group Vermont for Single Payer, has campaigned for universal health care in her state since 2003. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Richter about the prospects for single-payer in Vermont and her view that if this legislation becomes law, Vermont may serve as a model for the rest of the nation, struggling to cover more citizens while controlling escalating health care costs.
Well, the goal of the overall bill, I mean, is to get to a Medicare for All type of system where essentially you'll be eligible for comprehensive health care at birth rather than waiting till you're 65. That's the overall goal. However, unfortunately or fortunately, I don't know how you, it depends on how you look at it, but unfortunately we are restricted by the national bill, which doesn't allow us to apply for certain waivers that we would need to get to a pure single payer until the year 2017. And that is where our congressional delegation comes in. We're trying to get some waivers, and it may actually require legislation to override parts of the Obama bill that would allow states to do this, as long as they offered more coverage for no increase in cost. So essentially, it would be Medicare for All, and if we can get the waivers, we would begin the system in 2014. So sort of this legislation is a roadmap for how to get there. We still have to work out the benefit package and the financing, and those are things that we're going to work out next year and the year after. And then we expect to, if we can get the waivers, we would then put this system in place in 2014. If not, unfortunately, we would have to comply with the national bill and not do it until 2017. So it's still a long way off, unfortunately, because of the national bill.
Dr. Richter, the health insurance companies that operate in Vermont, would they be totally put out of business if the single-payer system were established there in your state? Or how would they operate at all in the new way?
Well, they would still be allowed to provide benefits for things that would not be provided under the insurance program. And because there is an ERISA law, we would actually not be able to eliminate them, per se, by law. We could effectively eliminate what they do, but we could not eliminate them, and there would still be some self-insured employers who effectively operate like insurance companies. But in general, for the most part, insurance companies would not be providing what the plan that would serve the Medicare for All plan would be serving. So they could offer additional benefits that weren't covered under the program, the regular public program. So So they would still be around for those particular benefits, but their role would be greatly reduced, and they would be used for claims processing. They could bid on the ability to do that for the state.
In reading about the history of Canada's single-payer system, it turns out that the province of Saskatchewan implemented their own single-payer system, much like Vermont would if this passes. And the success in Saskatchewan was an example to the federal government, and then they soon adopted single-payer for the entire nation of Canada. Do you see Vermont playing a similar role here in the United States, if indeed single-payer is a success in Vermont?
Absolutely. I mean, I think actually what we would end up seeing is sort of like a regional plan that we would probably get the Northeast and then eventually the rest of the country. I mean, there's no two ways about it. Single payer is a much more fiscally conservative way to cover everyone. I'm always surprised that we don't get more conservatives in favor of this, because you spend less money on health care under a single payer health care system. You spend less money on paperwork and a higher percentage on medical care, and people get broader coverage, and then that's more money to be spent in other areas of the economy. So I'm always amazed that this isn't more popular amongst people who tend to be fiscal conservatives, because it is definitely the best way to cover everybody. But I do think it'll happen, and I think it'll actually end up being not so much a moral question, but more of an economic one. And we are definitely reaching the tipping point where, when you have a high percentage of the middle class who are affected by the healthcare issue, that's when you get social change. And I really do believe that's going to happen here. I mean, I think what people need to really understand, that if you don't pay for Joe, you don't pay for the guy that was there the day before you, how can you be sure that the emergency room is going to be there for you? I mean, this is really a question of a public good more than a question of a human right. So this is not something that we can ignore. So I think it's important for us to recognize that if we want it there for us, we have to pay for everybody.
That was Dr. Deborah Richter, president of the group Vermont for Single Payer. Find more information on Vermont's single payer health care legislation on our website at btlonline.org.
On the 29th of March, the U.S. Supreme Court heard the case of Walmart Stores versus Dukes, which is Walmart's appeal of the class action suit Dukes versus Walmart certification as a class action. If the case survives certification as a class action, it will be the largest class action lawsuit in all U.S. history, as millions of women state that Walmart has discriminated systematically against them in employment. In front of the Supreme Court were protesters demanding equal pay for women working at Walmart and supporters of the D.C. movement to keep Walmart from opening in D.C. at all. Here's a little bit of what Miss Betty Dukes herself had to say in front of the Supreme Court. There were so many corporate reporters, I couldn't get close enough for better audio than this, though few of their stories ever saw light of day.
I bought this case because I believe that there was a pattern of discrimination at Walmart, not just in my store, but in the country. We have filed up I have heard women telling me basically the same story in mind, the disparate treatment and lack of promotion as well in lack of pay.
It's too bad this class action lawsuit against Walmart for sex discrimination, even though it's the largest class action lawsuit in U.S. history, won't be big enough to sink Walmart for good. Walmart's corporate practices are so bad they deserve to go out of business. From systematic discrimination against women and others they don't like, to deliberate efforts to exterminate all other businesses, to, quote, capture 100% of the market in every town they enter, to their terrible anti-union practices, their closing of stores where a union is organized, and the lowest wages in all retail, Walmart deserves to go out of business, not to enter Washington, D.C. Let's keep D.C. Walmart free. Remember that attempt
to close the West End Library in 2007. The one where the required public hearing was held on the 5th of July, the day after the fireworks. Well, those fat pigs at East Bank have once again pushed legislation through the city council to let them close the library and build condos on the site, hopefully to include a new library in the end. Here's a sample of our own radio coverage of what happened last time after a second public hearing.
This is Dial Tone for WSQT Radio. Library closing alert. The city council has passed legislation to sell the West End Library to East Bank, the same corporation that finances development in Georgetown. On Saturday, July 14, 2007, Joe Sternley, Vice President of Acquisition for East Bank, came to speak to the library. He was met with a crowd that had just been pumped up by an energetic rally outside, put together by Empower DC's People's Property Campaign, as well as some friends of the library.
Yes, sir. If indeed East Bank is does not want to be secretive, if indeed East Bank does not want to be secretive, then I take that to mean East Bank is for good government. As a member of this community, I insist upon a competitive bidding of ideas for this library site. And
now, with Fendi and the unwelcome spotlight he attracted gone, those fat slugs at East Bank think they can force the community to accept the closure of yet another library. Some community groups have given up and are settling for attempts to get concessions out of the deal. How about East Bank paying taxes to the city in excess of all that taxpayer money they will get to tear down a perfectly good library so they can sell condos for profit? How about we kick the rich off welfare and keep our libraries open?
After weeks of enormous demonstrations in Wisconsin, Ohio, Indiana, as well as other states, people from all walks of life challenged Republican governors attempting to weaken workers' rights. Union activists protested across the country on April 4th in what they called We Are One rallies. Over 1,000 protests, teach-ins, and other events marked the day 43 years ago when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. The civil rights leader was in Memphis to support the city's unionized sanitation workers who were on strike for fair wages and treatment. The coordinated assault by conservative governors on public employees' right to collective bargaining has resulted in a nationwide backlash. Recent public opinion polls have found that a large majority of Americans oppose the GOP campaign to scapegoat teachers, firefighters, policemen, and other middle-class workers for large state deficits produced by the nation's economic meltdown triggered by Wall Street's unethical speculation. The labor movement and their allies are fighting back on a number of fronts, including the collection of signatures for recall campaigns targeting 8 Wisconsin Republican senators who backed Governor Scott Walker's anti-union bill, and a statewide referendum in Ohio to reject legislation gutting workers' rights initiated by Governor John Kasich. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Andrew Kroll, a reporter in the D.C. Bureau of Mother Jones magazine, who discusses labor's response to the corporate-backed conservative political and economic attack on unions and the middle class, explored in his recent article titled Return to Wisconsin, the Beginning or the End.
Over the 2+ weeks I spent in Madison, this was in the end of February and getting into the very beginning of March, you know, I saw an outpouring of support, people young and old, of all races, all ethnicities, getting out in the street and mobilizing and getting angry and writing snarky signs and banging on drums and writing, you know, posting banners inside this beautiful rotunda at the Wisconsin State Capitol. And it was amazing. It was inspiring in the literal sense of the word, not the cliched use of inspiring that people often use, but it was a sight to behold. The broader takeaway, you know, as I write in this story, is still unclear, but I came away optimistic for a lot of reasons. Obviously, if Republican Governor Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, if his anti-union bill passes, it will be a major blow to labor unions in his state. we've seen these kinds of bills or these kinds of measures enacted in other states, most notably in Indiana, and the result has been a serious kneecapping of unions' power in these states to bargain, to keep up their membership, to really have a voice at the bargaining table, if they're going to the bargaining table at all. Now, Walker's bill is still in legal limbo. Now, it remains to be seen whether it is going to become law soon or later this year or at all. We saw so many people coming together in Madison, not just tried and true organizers who have been in the trenches before, but students, both at the college level and at the high school level, and older retirees, and people at the end of their working careers, coming together and mobilizing like never before, not in their lifetimes, and not in their communities like this. You know, I tell the story of one 22-year-old guy named Tom Bird in my story, a nuclear engineering master's student, total whiz kid, scrawny geek, who was radicalized by these events, and within the span of weeks became this diehard labor organizer, you know, a real compassionate guy, you know, hard on his sleeve, who just doesn't think what the governor's doing is right. Wasn't that political, wasn't that active before, and now he's starting his own organizations, he's organizing rallies, he's bringing in speakers like John Nichols, like the top Democrats in the Wisconsin legislature. So seeing Tom and seeing other people, the other Toms in the crowd, that was inspiring, and that ultimately gave me more hope than the despair I saw in the possibility of unions in that state being knocked down, because you know, maybe if unions lose their clout and there's this vacuum here, maybe people like Tom and others will fill that gap with some new kind of organizing power, some new kind of organization or force.
Andy, there's a certain partisan political dimension and motivation to what some of these Republican governors are doing to eviscerate public sector unions in their states. Talk a little bit about what you see in terms of the end game here, how some of these Republican governors really want to defund the Democratic Party, of which the unions are a prime base of support, door knocking, but also money contributions.
Any Republican lawmaker who, during these debates on these anti-union bills throughout the country, says that there's no political element to these efforts is lying. I think when they're speaking candidly or caught off guard, these Republicans in Wisconsin and elsewhere have admitted so much that there are serious political consequences to knocking out public sector unions who are, as you said, a pillar of support for the Democratic Party, not only in get-out-the-vote efforts, in knocking on doors, but in fundraising. You know, AFSCME, which is one of the biggest, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, is one of the biggest players in campaign finance and money in politics today. They're a huge supporter of the Democratic Party, and especially at the state level, this is true. So what we're seeing in all these, you know, more than 20 states around the country, is not just an effort to undercut unions, but an effort to, as you said, defund the Democratic Party very much at the state level. If you knock out public sector unions at the state level, you are almost dealing a death blow to those Democratic parties.
It seems clear that labor unions' tactics over recent decades have not worked to draw more people to the union movement, and they've lost great numbers of membership over recent years. Do you see what's happening across the country in these battles over public sector unions as a trigger to wake labor unions out of maybe the same old thing they've been doing for many years and sort of spark some new thinking there?
In the near term, this fight, I think, will be good for labor unions. I don't think that this fight is the kind of event that galvanizes labor unions to the point where they can reverse decades-long trends. The forces at play for why this membership has declined can't be countered by what we're seeing now, even though unions are fighting for their lives. I'm talking about globalization. I'm talking about the Democratic Party's, at least at the national level, their decision over, and this has been going on for 30 years, to move more toward corporate America than to embrace their union roots. And it also ties into, you know, where the money is coming from to fund our elections. You know, in the aftermath of the Citizens United decision, corporations have an ever more powerful role in deciding who wins and who loses. And both Democrats and Republicans will be looking to corporations and not necessarily looking to labor unions as much, and that hurts the unions and their clout. I don't think we're going to see unions completely wiped off the map. I think with their backs to the wall, they're going to fight like all get out. And maybe we could see a small resurgence in the near term, but it's going to take something far larger than this fight. It's going to have to take major global economic changes to bring unions back to the point where we saw them, say, in the 60s or 70s.
That was Andrew Kroll, a reporter in the D.C. Bureau of Mother Jones Magazine and associate editor with TomDispatch.com. For a link to Kroll's recent articles on the labor struggle, visit our website at btlonline.org.
The 1st of April is known among environmental activists as Fossil Fool's Day. Here in D.C., the greenwash gorillas targeted Pepco for the second year in a row. A spokesman said in a press release that Pepco should just rename themselves Pepcoal if they're going to keep promoting these fossil fuels as our electricity sources instead of wind and solar. On the morning of April the 1st, the greenwash gorillas did exactly that, changing the signs on Pepco's 9th Street headquarters to read Pepcoal instead of Pepco. The previous night, hundreds of mock Pepcoal advertising posters were installed on Metro trains reading, quote, "We deal with toxicity so you don't have to," and showing the orange polluted bathwater from coal and filthy coal-burning smokestacks. About half of Pepco's electricity comes from burning coal, and Pepco refuses to admit how much of it comes from mountaintop removal coal mining. Despite the promises Pepco spokesman Clay Anderson made last year. Late afternoon on the 1st of April, Fossil Fool's Day continued as environmental activists joined the monthly Critical Mass bicycle ride. Over 50 riders on bicycles departed from DuPont Circle for the Cherry Blossom Festival in Haynes Point, demonstrating one alternative to fossil fuels. The cherry blossoms are a symbol of Japan, now battling what could turn into the worst nuclear crisis in all history. By riding to the Cherry Blossom Festival, climate activists in the ride hope to point out that nuclear energy is no solution either. Just ask the nuclear samurai, the courageous workers in Japan who may be giving their lives trying to contain the damage from the leaking, overheated reactor. The people supporting coal, oil, and nuclear energy are truly fossil fools. Fossil fuels for dinosaur people.